Most people associate C.S. Lewis with either children's stories, The Chronicles of Narnia, or Christian apologetics, Mere Christianity, The Problem of Pain, Miracles, The Screwtape Letters. And he was certainly a gifted storyteller and defender of Christian truth. What many forget, however, assuming that they knew it all, is that Lewis had a day job. Lewis was a fellow and tutor in English literature at Oxford University from 1925 to 1954, when he was made chair of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge University. That is, C.S. Lewis was, first and foremost, a university professor and literary scholar. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host for Wyoming Catholic College's After Dinner Scholar podcasts. As a child, Lewis was steeped in, and as an adult, he taught many of what we today call the great books, including Chaucer, Spenser, John Milton, and the subject of today's conversation, Dante. Lewis read Dante's Inferno in Italian as a teenager. He read Purgatorio in the hospital during World War I as he recovered from wounds he received in the trenches. Then, some years later, once he gave up his atheism, but before he embraced Christianity, Lewis finally read Paradiso and was enraptured. This past February 3rd, Dr. Jason Baxter, assistant professor of fine arts and humanities at Wyoming Catholic College, delivered a lecture entitled Evil Enchantment and the Weight of Glory, What Dante Taught C.S. Lewis About Poetry. Dr. Baxter's research interests include not only Dante and C.S. Lewis, but all of the other philosophers, poets, and writers that Lewis studied and loved. Dr. Baxter, welcome.
Thank you.
Many have commented that we live in a disenchanted world, but I was intrigued that in your lecture you talked about ways in which the world is wrapped in an evil enchantment. What do you mean by that? How has our culture become both disenchanted and enchanted?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Yeah, Charles Taylor, in his book, A Secular Age, talks about the disenchantment of the world, and he says it's a combination of a number of factors which have led to us not being able to feel spiritual presence or holiness in the midst of the natural world. Not necessarily that we disbelieve that it exists, but that it doesn't feel palpable and near. And that's really, you know, in a thumbnail, his sketch of how he went from the ancient world to the modern world. But Lewis has this idea that the modern world is almost allergic to the idea, the old idea of an enchanted world, and thus seeks, sometimes almost in a militant fashion, to silence any sort of interior voice which might be awakened to suggest that there is something greater. So what I in my lecture called the Platonic voice of longing or aching, what Lewis in his autobiography called joy, the sort of voice that would suggest that there's a kind of beauty which can't be satisfied even by the object which invites a strong response. The modern world, according to Lewis, almost suffocates that or drowns it out. And thus, if one is for Lewis a kind of good spell or holy enchantment by which a voice sort of speaks through the natural object of beauty to raise our minds to a higher level, the modern world casts a kind of evil enchantment which tries to suffocate or drown out that experience.
Mm-hmm. Or to turn it into an experience that's purely a subjective experience.
Precisely, yeah, exactly. That's what Lewis talks about in The Abolition of Man, doesn't he? That the little green book, the schoolboy textbook, which Lewis graciously leaves anonymous, tries to convince or unwittingly convinces the schoolboy that a response to the waterfall as sublime is merely a record of his own subjective encounter. Right.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't tell us anything beyond that about the nature of the world or the nature of the good or the nature of God.
Exactly. It doesn't is unlike say a platonic longing. It doesn't operate through the beautiful object in this world to awaken a desire for something beyond it, but is sort of contained within itself.
And you mentioned that even the way that we talk about the world, used the example of C.S. Lewis's character Uncle Andrew in The Magician's Nephew, has become commoditized and vague and lifeless, really.
Yeah, I think Uncle Andrew might be my favorite character. I mean, he makes children laugh and he makes adults laugh at the same time, but for perhaps different reasons. Yeah, Uncle Andrew in Magician's Nephew has the privilege of seeing the beginning of Narnia, seeing the cosmos brought into being by means of song. Lewis and Tolkien seem to have been thinking about this together. Because Tolkien does the same thing, has the world sung into existence at the beginning of the Silmarillion, doesn't he? And so Uncle Andrew is here, is presented this extraordinary sight. I mean, greater than any opera or film or symphony, song or language, which actually brings into existence that which it describes, sort of fills creature with fire and life and happiness. And Uncle Andrew looks at it and says, "We could really turn a profit on this." He sees that the soil possesses a kind of magical fertility and richness, and his next and only thought is how that could be turned into economic profit, into columns of profit on an accountant's ledger.
Now, I was thinking about the characters in the comedy. Are there any characters kind of similar? I mean, he's not a comic character in the sense that you want to laugh at him, but I was thinking of Farinata, kind of living in hell, in a fiery grave, in a world that even by Dante's time doesn't even exist anymore, being concerned about things that are so utterly temporal that they're already gone. Is he kind of similar kind of character?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's got to be some sort of similarity there. I suppose the striking thing about Dante's comic characters in his book, The Comedy, is that they're not funny, right? I mean, it's the least funny book entitled Comedy you'll ever read. I suppose in a sort of sad and twisted way, they take themselves, the sinners in hell, take themselves so seriously that they're incapable of recognizing the irony or the comedy of their situation. The comedy that, in some sense, they're being given precisely what they've always wanted and what they always ask for, and are still, in an interesting way, allowed their freedom and are being given the object which they choose, and are angry at God for allowing them to get what they want. But I suppose in Dante's comedy, nothing is funny. These characters are too proud and grip the world too tightly to be able to see anything as funny or ironic, especially themselves.
Now, talk to us a little bit about Dante's poetry and what Lewis would have learned from him.
I mean, we know that Lewis loved Dante's poetry for almost all of his life, encountering it first, seemingly just kind of learning a language. He writes home to his father, say, "I've begun to study Italian. That way, at the very least, if I don't get into Oxford, I'll have a third modern language, which will help me to become a good civil servant." So what might have begun as a kind of, interestingly enough, was a sort of utilitarian beginning, very quickly became a love and a deep interest. He reads Paradiso again in his 20s with one of his best friends, Owen Barfield. And from then it seems that almost kind of like Alice falling down the hole in Alice in Wonderland, cannot ever sort of reach the bottom of his admiration for this poem that he just loves so dearly. And it seems that in some ways he's spent, I would say, a good portion of his scholarly and adult life trying to come up with reasons to articulate why the reading experience of the comedy is so profound. And he comes up with a couple of different reasons. He has two really interesting reasons, which I talked about in my talk. The first is that he thought that Dante, living in a pre-modern world, before the age of disenchantment, was able to speak about the cosmos in a way which was more poetic, because the world in which he dwelt was inherently more poetic. So just a realistic description for Dante of how the world moves in its sort of graceful symphonic motions, how the sun nourishes the earth, right, are less metaphorical than they would be for us. For us, it's a clever use of the imagination to liken the earth to a breathing, living thing. But Lewis contends that for Dante, it's hardly a metaphor, just as a realist. And so at one point in one of his essays, Lewis jokes that sometimes when I'm reading Dante, I hardly think he has anything to do. All he has to do is just sort of give voice to the world and let it express itself. So I think that's the first reason that, one of the reasons that Lewis gives that he admired Dante so much. I think the second reason he gives is because, to steal from Lewis's title of his best-known sermon, The Weight of Glory, that Dante gives an admirable solidity or weight to his vision of those most abstract things. And this is something that Lewis is concerned about the entirety of his life. He writes about it in Transposition, he writes about it in Miracles, he writes about it in The Weight of Glory. That is, for most of us Christians, a vision of heaven and perhaps a vision of goodness as well just seems so shadowy and abstract and distant and vague that even, say, if we claim allegiance to Christianity and want to be good, it doesn't have any sort of thickness or viscousness or weight. And so Lewis began in one of his wonderful essays, a scholarly essay about Dante's use of imagery and similes in the last 11 canti of the Paradiso. Lewis compliments Dante that he continually tries to make these abstract, distant things, such as heaven and sanctity, and render them close and concrete, and perhaps even have a kind of tangibility, palpability, and weight, which can actually appeal to our affections, as opposed to most of the visions of heaven of, say, golden crowns and white robes and singing, which leave us rather cold. Lewis points out that sometimes our popular imagination of heaven is one that secretly makes us a little bit sad. That is, to go to heaven means leaving behind all the rich, full-bodied pleasures of the earth. But of course, Lewis, throughout the entirety of his life, is so concerned to try to destroy those vague feelings and replace them with strong desires. Because, in his opinion, that world really is truer, denser, and happier than this one, even on his best day.
Yeah, it makes me think of The Great Divorce, where
exactly
where people arrive at the outskirts of heaven, and they're not real enough even to tread the grass properly.
That's right. They walk on the grass and it cuts their feet. They look at the sun and it burns their eyes. They drink the water and it scalds their throat with its purity. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not that heaven has density. In reality, it's us who are too shadowy and too unreal to fully drink it.
Right. Yeah. And Dante has that similar kind of sense where there is a deeper reality there. And as you read the comedy, I can't exactly put my finger on it, but it seems to me you do go from a shadowy kind of existence in the Inferno to something that, that just feels solid in Paradiso.
That's kind of an unexpected journey. Mm-hmm. That, of course, most of us culturally speaking, right? The joke is, right, is that you'd rather have your pleasure and be in hell, right? I'd rather go be surfing in hell than, singing with a bunch of angels on lutes in heaven. And if that really were the case, it is, maybe that response is understandable. But Dante, perhaps has this sort of surprising journey in which reality gets denser and realer and has increasingly assumes that weight, precisely as you think that as you get closer to heaven and go farther up, it would begin to dissipate like thin air in the atmosphere. But rather, Dante, through a number of marvelous devices, metaphors, his description of how the saints receive the pilgrim, how the smile of Beatrice continues to draw him up, and a number of other devices, manages to give that sort of admirable, as Lewis put it, admirable solidity to the Paradiso.
Mm-hmm. And Lewis picked up that same kind of use of imagery in his writings.
I think so. Yeah, I think Lewis is concerned with, throughout so much of his life, he's concerned with making sure that we recognize that land to which we are oriented, that it calls that far off country, right, after the Platonic tradition, or in other words, heaven and the love of God, that it creates that positive yearning and that positive desire, which he thought that it was easier to come by in the Middle Ages. So I think Lewis thought that by writing children's stories, he is probably almost, treating us as we need to be treated as children, almost as sort of beginning the education all over again, is what the medieval man could have, as he says at one point, drunk with his beer and eaten with his bread, for us has to be learned. And one wonders if that's actually why writing children's stories was so important for him, mm-hmm. because as an educator, he actually felt he had to begin from the absolute foundation.
And suddenly I'm thinking about Rinpoche and his little coracle going flying over the edge of the world to Aslan's country.
Right, what in particular?
Well, just, his desire for it is beyond anything else he desires. So he hops in the coracle and he is delighted as he goes up the wave and over the end into
That's
Aslan's
country. Yeah, exactly. That's a great image of positive yearning or positive desire. That for Rinpoche, unlike for the rest of the crew members, has a strong sense of the goodness which awaits him, the kind of faith of Abraham. And he's willing to sort of joyfully and zealously pursue this end because he has a medieval imagination, I suppose.
Uh-huh. Good. Well, Dr. Baxter, thank you very much.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
If this conversation with Dr. Baxter has piqued your interest, and we hope it has, please visit the Wyoming Catholic College website to listen to Dr. Baxter's lecture in its entirety. As Dante, Lewis, and Dr. Baxter tell us, goodness is not simply a list of forbidden thoughts, words, and deeds. Goodness is glorious, even crushing in its beauty and power. It is, whether we realize it or not, the desire of all human hearts. To grasp it is boundless joy in this life and the next, and to miss it is utter misery in this life and the next. We can be grateful for guides like Dante and C.S. Lewis, not to mention, of course, the biblical authors and thinkers such as Aristotle, Augustine, and Aquinas. We invite you to subscribe and to join us for our future podcasts as we explore their writings and follow their lead. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.